Good evening, this is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1221, we present two more stories from new Life Rattle writer, Sean Gupta. Tonight's featured stories, full of humor and heart, show us the life of a suburban boy maturing into a young man. Our featured writer, Sean Gupta, was born in 1990 in Mississauga, Ontario. His family moved to Thunder Bay when he was 5 and returned to Mississauga a year later. Growing up, Sean always felt like he had 4 parents: his mom, his dad, and his 2 older sisters, 10 and 11 years his senior. He grew up with plenty of conflicting career advice from his 4 parents, but ultimately chose to pursue a career in medicine. Sean expects to be in school for a long time. He's earned a health science and chemistry undergraduate degree in biology and now plans to spend a couple of years in cancer research for his graduate studies. Then he will test his luck and apply to med school. The stories we played last week began with a young boy and brought us up to a young adult working in Panama to set up village clinics. This week we are back in Canada. The first story takes us to the old heart of Mississauga at Dundas and here Ontario Streets. Our narrator is filling quiet time at the electronics store he works for when all hell breaks loose. Let's listen now as Sean Gupta reads his story, Attention, tonight on Life Rattle.
Attention, by Sean Gupta. I reach into the right pocket of my tan chinos and pull out my black iPhone. I click the home button and my screen comes to life. The phone displays that it's 5:15 p.m. How have I only been at work for an hour? I lean against the glass showcase and stare out the glass door at the old man with a black toque. I watch as he walks along the sidewalk, his gaze focused on the ground. He bends down and picks up 3 cigarette butts off the concrete. He pulls out a lighter, lights one of the butts, inhales the smoke, exhales, and then walks back towards an alley behind the Curry Palace next door. I've worked at Link It Up right off the corner of Here Ontario and Dundas in Mississauga as a sales associate for the past 6 years. My sister Riti is good friends with the owner of the store. When I turned 16, I told her I wanted a job, and she hooked it up. I didn't even have to fill out a job application or go to an interview. I like to think I'm qualified for the job, though. Katy Perry's Hot and Cold plays from the speaker in the cracked ceiling tile above. I swear this is the millionth time I've heard this song today. Why do we only get 1 radio station? I look around the store. A white poster with the giant Samsung Galaxy smartphone covers a dark blue wall, along with the poster with the Bell Mobility logo. Metal bars that cover a window remind me of a prison cell. I hear a rustling from the back office and freeze. Oh no, Amit's coming. I need to pretend to be busy. But there are no customers to help out. I look around. Fingerprints stain the glass showcases. But I hate cleaning. I guess I could update the prices on the phone case. Nah, that's too much work. There are lots of empty boxes on the counter behind me that need to be thrown out. Perfect, easy work. As I pack the garbage can with junk, I look up and see Amit walking towards me. I stare at the hair that hugs the side of his naked brown head. Perfect timing. What are you doing? Amit asks. I'm just cleaning up, I tell him. There's so much junk in the back that I thought I should probably throw that all out before I start doing other work, right? I wait for an answer. That's completely unacceptable, he responds in a stern voice. My forehead feels moist. I know. I need to work harder. I know my sales haven't been great this month, either. I promise I'm going to work on it. I look at Amit for approval, but see none. He stares at me blankly. Vlad, can I just put you on hold for a second? My employee is trying to say something to me. He raises his index finger and jabs his ear, Sean, what are you going on about? I look at his ear and see a black Motorola Bluetooth headset. My face turns red. Oh, never mind, nothing. Amit looks at me with the raised eyebrow and walks back into the back office. I sigh. Ding dong, chimes the doorbell. A man swaggers in towards me. A black do-rag covers his head. His faded jeans hang from his knees, and his black oversized sweatshirt covers everything in between, up to his neck. Yo, do you have any blackberries? He asks in a deep voice. Definitely. What kind of blackberry were you looking for? I reply over-enthusiastically. What's the best one? Well, that would have to be the BlackBerry Bold 9780. It has everything you would want in a smartphone. Wi-Fi, a 2-megapixel camera, 3G, and of course you get BBM. Oh, sick. Let me see that. I walk over and unlock the first glass showcase and pull out the shiny BlackBerry. The original stickers are still intact. As I hand it to him, I see him staring at another smartphone beside it. I see you're looking at the BlackBerry Curve 9300. That's a great phone. It doesn't have the same processing ability as the Bold, but the ergonomic design of the phone more than compensates for that. Sick. Let me see that one too. I hand him the other phone. I stare at him as he holds a phone in each of his big, chalky hands. A few minutes go by, and he continues to hold and stare at the phones. I hope he picks the Bold. I'll make sick commission off that. I turn my head and look out the glass door again. It's getting cloudy. I hope it doesn't rain. Bam! I hear the glass showcase rattle. I swing my head back to see what the commotion is about, and the man no longer stands in front of me. Out of the side of my vision, I see a black blur take two giant leaps and is already halfway across the store. Ding dong, chimes the doorbell. The man disappears. Fuck, I'm gonna be in so much trouble when Amit finds out. I turn around and walk straight back into the back office. Amit sits at his glass desk, staring at his computer screen. Amit? I stutter. My arms tremble. He's now typing on his keyboard. Amit? Yes, Sean? That guy just ran away with a Bold and a Curve. What? He yells. Where did he go? Before I can reply, Amit jumps out of his black leather chair and bolts towards the front of the store. He leans over the glass showcase, stares at the row of phones neatly placed on their stands, and glares at the two empty stands. He stays silent, but I see his face turn red. I'm so sorry, Amit. I don't know what happened. I look at him and look down at the ground. What do you mean you don't know what happened? Amit screams as he points his index finger at the empty phone stands in the glass showcase. How could you just hand him two phones worth $1,000 and let him leave with them? I don't know. It all just happened so fast. One second I was helping him, then I looked away for a second, and the next second he was gone. How many times have I told you to pay attention when helping out a customer? Amit continues to yell. You're lucky you're Riti's little brother. Otherwise, this would be coming out of your paycheck. I shift my gaze to the left of his head and stare out the glass door and see the man with the black toque. He slowly walks along the sidewalk, looking at the ground. Then he stops, bends down, and picks up a cigarette butt. He looks around and continues walking.
That was Sean Gupta reading his story, Attention. Tonight's second story has quite a different spin. Our narrator interviews a biology professor at University of Toronto, Mississauga. He learns of the economics of cancer research and gets the scoop on the doctor's Aston Martin. Let's listen now as Sean Gupta reads his story, Molecular Templates.
Molecular Templates by Sean Gupta. I walk into the Master of Biotechnology office at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, holding two medium double-doubles. I walk towards a closed door inside the office. The nameplate on the door reads Lee Revers, Associate Director of M Biotech. I knock lightly, taking care not to spill the cups of coffee. There's no reply. "Hey, so sorry I'm late. I was caught up in a meeting," explains Dr. Revers in a British accent as he walks up from behind me. He wears a dark brown beard, thin-rimmed glasses, and a gray sweater. He glances at my hands and says, "Is that coffee for me?" "Yep," I say. "Great, that's the perfect way to start a meeting." Dr. Revers smiles at me and then turns to one of his colleagues who sits across from us. "Hey, Greg, look at what my student got me. He got me coffee." Dr. Revers ushers me into the meeting room at the right of his office. We sit across from each other at a large glass boardroom table. On one wall hangs a whiteboard with the words net present value, the time value of money, written in red marker, followed by a mathematical formula. To the left of the whiteboard sits two Apple iMac computers and a big LCD flat-screen television mounted on the wall. Beneath the TV, a dark oak wall unit sports a stainless steel microwave, a stainless steel espresso machine, and a glass chess set. "So, what would you like to interview me about, Sean?" asks Dr. Revers. "Well, I was hoping you could tell me about that biotech company you created and sold for $5 million before you started teaching here at UTM. "Okay, everyone wants to hear that story. Why don't you start by telling me about the drug you developed?" Dr. Revers sits back in his chair. "Well, we started studying this molecule called shiga-like toxin, which is from bacteria that makes you sick. It's what causes hamburger disease. You know, when Jack in the Box had those outbreaks of E. coli poisoning? Those E. coli are normally quite friendly, and you have them in your gut all the time, but these particular E. coli strains have a bunch of extra genes that make them rather nasty, and one of those encodes for a nasty protein that's really toxic. It's as toxic as ricin, which is one of the most toxic substances out there, so it kills cells really well. The idea was, if we can kill cells with this stuff, maybe we can tailor it to kill the cells we wanted. So the question was, what kind of cells would you want to kill? Cancer cells. So we worked with this bacterium that kills cells and made it selective for cancer cells." "So what happened next?" I asked. "Well, we developed this idea and tried to shop it around. Everyone really liked it. Then we went around and raised capital from venture capitalists. These are people who take risks by investing in new ideas. I distinctly remember going to anonymous offices for a number of months and going up glass elevators into tall buildings and going into relatively indistinguishable conference rooms to meet people who would be interested in our technology, or not. And we managed to corral a group of people who were interested, and they gave us $500,000 in cash, enabling us to start this company." Dr. Revers stops talking and takes a sip of his coffee and continues. "So, we created molecular templates. It was incorporated in Ontario. I had a big piece of the ownership. It was very exciting. For 7 years, we were set up in a laboratory no bigger than this room. It couldn't have been bigger than 400 square feet. I imagine a team of scientists crammed into a small room and laugh. Wow, I can't believe you even got any work done in such a small place. On top of that, we were kind of like a company working inside a hospital on a deadly toxin, which is kind of weird. But that's all okay. But then one day we realized that maybe our technology wouldn't work. And you have to recognize that 299 of every 300 drugs that go into clinical trials fail. And we weren't even in clinical trials yet, So it was very likely that we were going to fail. It's like playing the lottery, really. But I think entrepreneurship is about being prepared to fail. You know, throwing yourself up at a brick wall until one day you smash through it, hopefully. "Wow, that's crazy," I tell him, as I look down to take a sip from my coffee. I notice Lee's shiny black dress shoes through the transparent table. "What happened next?" Now we get to the more interesting part of the story, when we started to run out of money. The Canadian funds began to siphon away, and we'd spent it all. And we knew that everybody was going to be out of a job. It's really quite a scary time, because you've worked with all these people for 7 years. So it was a sad day when in February 2007, the company closed its doors for the last time. I came to work here at the university, and after that, and left that life behind. At least I thought I did. But naturally, you can't leave those things behind. They're a part of you. And as founder, that's particularly difficult to let go. It's like having a child. So I went around giving presentations to try and find investors, and by chance I was introduced to Stephanie DeGrandis, and it just so happened that she was the woman who had cloned the gene for Shigalic toxin, the molecule I'd been working on for the last 7 years. She was very excited when she learned about what I'd been doing, and she said she didn't want this project to die. She said she'd help introduce me to whomever she could that might express an interest. So I was lucky enough to be introduced to some American investors who had actually come up from Pittsburgh. Stephanie had organized this showcase, and she invited me to present. I gave my presentation, and it was pretty gloomy, to be honest, but Stephanie came to me after lunch and said they really liked it. So we discussed it more over dinner, and they invited me down to Pittsburgh. They introduced me to their specialist in oncology, Frank Zafferstein, which, by the way, is a great name. He looked at it, and he really liked it. Dr. Reber pauses and takes a sip of his coffee. The silver watch on his arm glows as it reflects the light from the window behind him. So we spent most of the summer putting together another presentation, and we went back down there for the final presentation, which happened to be the day when U.S. Treasury bills went through the floor. It was Black Monday. We were going to seal the deal for like $3 million U.S., and they literally that day pulled the rug out from under us and said, "We are hemorrhaging cash. We can't give you the capital. We can't make any more investments because the whole financial community is grinding to a halt as we speak." They make decisions that fast. When we flew back, we were pretty depressed. But I got a phone call a week afterwards, and my partner, Eric Palmer, said, "You know what? I still think we have a chance. I still believe in this technology. I have a friend down in Texas, and he expressed an interest in this. Let's try that." So we started all over again. This time we had to go to Austin, Texas, to meet these people with big 10-gallon hats and shoestring ties. And they really liked the technology, and they really liked Eric as well. I don't know what they thought about me. Dr. Rever pauses, looks away from me, and laughs. "But that's fine." So we went through the process again, and this time they set a date to close, and it was in the spring of 2009. I flew down and I went to the hotel, and we cracked some champagne, and they actually signed. "Wow, they signed right there?" I ask. "Right there, they actually signed. We had a slap-up meal where they ordered cake bread, a fantastic California red wine, which is among the greatest red wines I've ever drank. They raised $2.5 million US, which was put into the company, and they reinvented it as Molecular Templates US, a Delaware incorporated company, which would be based outside of Austin, Texas, in a place called Georgetown. That's now where it is." "Wow," I say. I could never have predicted that sequence of events. By luck, I was introduced to each of these people. I mean, there's no way that chain of events could ever have been predicted, and yet it led to success. So, is Molecular Template still open? I ask. It is. In fact, the news is very good. I mean, molecules that they've developed are about to enter into clinical trials in hospitals. Are they still working on the sugar-like toxin? They are. It's still based on the sugar-like toxin. The candidate I found in 2004 in Canada is actually still being developed. So that's good, and it's actually going to be put into a clinical trials program at Neil General Hospital. That's awesome. It's very exciting indeed. From my perspective, you could argue the only success is to find a drug that cures cancer. But no drug cures cancer. So, at what point do you measure success? I'm going to sit back and say if the molecule I've discovered and was involved in ends up in a patient, then that is a major success, even if it doesn't work, because that is a huge leap. Now, who knows? It might even show some benefit, and that's even more exciting. So, when in the process did your Aston Martin come? Heh, that's a very good sort of endnote to the whole thing. Well, I turned 40 in 2010. And when I turned 40, I just decided I wanted to do some of the things that had been burning me, sort of irritating me, for a long time that other people seemed to have managed to do. And purchasing a great car was one of those things. I was lucky enough to go and view one, and I just fell in love with it. And I realized if I left it until I was 50, which is probably when I could genuinely afford it, I wouldn't be able to get in or out of it because they're so low to the ground. I would need assistance. I burst into laughter. Trust me, it's hard even in your 20s. I'm sure lots of people look at me and think, what a complete stuck-up prat from England driving in an Aston Martin. But there's quite a lot of people who secretly want that car, right? I've made it happen. And it was something I could predict, unlike all that other stuff that happened to me that I couldn't predict. I wanted something I could predict. I could walk into the showroom, write a check. It was a big check, and drove off. I think one of the highlights of the last couple of years was going to collect that car. It was pristine, and it was actually sitting in the showroom, and I got in and drove it away. There's something about that. Wow, how many people can say that? Well, whoever's bought an Aston Martin can say that, but not that many. Some people say, don't you think it's a bad signal to send to students to have an Aston Martin? And I counter with no. I don't think it is. I think that students would rather have a prof who has an Aston Martin than one who wears patches on his arms and has open-toed sandals. People come up to me and say, I expect you to drive a Volvo. And they couldn't be further from the truth. And it kind of puts a hole in stereotypes, which I really appreciate because I don't want to be stereotyped. Even when I lecture, I hope to be different from everyone else in one way or another, even if it's in a way that students don't appreciate sometimes. A lot of people do appreciate it, though, I point out. Well, that's just it. In the end, you can never please all of your audience, and you'll be in this situation one day too. But it's important to please yourself, and I don't mean as to please yourself in a very sort of flippant way, but you do have to make yourself happy, because no one else is responsible for your happiness other than you. Okay, I know you have to get going now, I say. Dr. Revers looks up at the clock to his right. Oh, I do. I was supposed to be in a meeting 5 minutes ago. Dr. Revers winds up around his desk, waits for me to exit, and closes the door behind him. Through the window in his door, I see the abandoned cup of coffee on his desk. I turn to tell him he's forgotten to take his coffee, but he's already gone.
That was Sean Gupta reading his story, Molecular Templates. That concludes Life Rattle number 1221. My name is Lori Callis. I recorded Sean reading his stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear brand new stories from new Life Rattle writer Michael Zingala.